From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone. This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance. And this week, I'm broadcasting from the historic, beautiful Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. The Chautauqua Institution is a truly special place, a place where visitors can attend lectures and conversations on some of the most important issues of our day. I'm here for the purpose of speaking at a week-long event on faith and public life, and I'll be joined shortly by the organizer of this conference, the head of the religion department here, Reverend Joan Brown Campbell. We're going to be discussing that ever-popular topic, faith and the election. Plus, Bruce Springsteen and religion? Coming up, a Unitarian minister offers us some spiritual insight courtesy of the boss. But before we head off to Thunder Road or, you know, start dancing in the dark, let's take a look at a news story that broke earlier this week. It involves an ad produced by the McCain campaign. And, you know, I have to say, this is one of the most disturbing attack ads that I have seen in recent years. No, this is not the ad accusing Obama of being a shallow celebrity in the vein of Paris Hilton or Lindsay Lohan. This ad is called The One. And, well, just take a listen to it.
It shall be known that in 2008 the world will be blessed. They will call him The One.
A nation healed, a world repaired. We are the ones we've been waiting for.
And he has anointed himself, ready to carry the burden of the One. To quote Barack, I have become a symbol of America, returning to our best traditions. He can do no wrong.
Do you have any doubts?
Never.
Can you see the light?
A light will shine down from somewhere. It will light upon you. You will experience an epiphany. And you will say to yourself, I have to vote for Barack.
And the world shall receive his blessings.
This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal.
Behold his mighty hand.
Barack Obama may be the one, but is he ready to lead?
Now here are the words of Obama, and as you heard them, you realize they're interspersed with an image of Charlton Heston as Moses parting the Red Sea. The ad portrays Obama supporters as if they were attending a religious revival, almost in a state of euphoric rapture, and the ad is lit with the soft hues reminiscent of a devotional Christian video. On the surface, the message is one that we've heard before. Does Barack Obama have the experience to lead this country? But when I look at the way that message is delivered, I have to tell you, I see something a lot more sinister going on. Joining me now to discuss this ad, our guest, Professor John L. Jackson, Jr. Professor Jackson teaches communication and anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. He often writes on racial politics, religion, and popular culture. John Jackson, welcome to State of Belief.
Thanks for having me.
Now, John, the word on the street is that this ad, this video, is really a veiled attempt to sour evangelicals against Obama, that by presenting Obama as kind of a, at first, messianic-looking figure, people realize that it's not that, that he's a false prophet, and that the McCain campaign is actually painting him as either the Antichrist or the forerunner to the Antichrist. There are groups, as our listeners may know, that believe the Antichrist will come in the form of a charismatic leader who presents himself as some sort of false savior. Now, am I reading too much into this ad, or do you see some of that too?
In my mind's eye, I think it was probably twofold. One thing they wanted to do was to knock, in some ways, knock Obama off of his pedestal. There's a discourse around his charismatic leadership that does seem to traffic in some assumptions, some sort of overflated presuppositions about his almost messianic ability to take America and bring it to the next level, as if one person alone could ever perform such a Herculean feat. So I think they just wanted to knock him off his pedestal. I do think at the same time, they couldn't have imagined they would convince some people who weren't already amenable to the idea, convince people that Obama was the Antichrist. I think what we might imagine could be a possible purposeful sort of subtext to the advertisement was the idea that if this notion is already circulating, then it might make sense to capitalize on this and feed the frenzy of some of these more extreme anti-Obama sorts of positions.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, now, have you heard this Antichrist charge before?
Well, I've been hearing this for years now. I mean, ever since really the 2004 Democratic National Convention, where he gave that famous speech. And I remember when I was watching it and some other folks I know, we were sort of tacking back and forth between Fox and CNN. Fox didn't like any of the Democrats, it seemed, that came on the stage that evening, except Obama. Obama, they said, seemed like a statesman. He seemed like this incredible young Turk who was about something, who had all the criteria you would want in a political figure. And it seemed like, well, why would Fox be invested in rubber stamping the Democrats' coronation around their young political figure? And the only thing people came to was, well, clearly, if he's that seductive, he might be one of these figures, right? These folks who have such a sort of mesmeric power about them that even the people who ideologically might imagine themselves to be opposed to what he stands for still somehow get seduced. So I remember this in 2004. Of course, Fox no longer has that sort of wide-eyed position. Yeah, they've gone after him at this point. But part of, I think, what we need to remember is there's something about his ability to command an audience, to get people engaged, excited, hopeful, that most politicians would pay to cultivate in themselves. And so it means often people's responses to him are responses to a figure whose power is often intangible. It's something that isn't just about the quality necessarily just of his ideas, but about his very performance of self. This ineffable, indescribable extra thing that makes a politician resonate with voters. And I think if you see someone like that, you try to marshal all your evidence, logical and illogical, to try to beat them back if you're the competition.
John, are we going to see more of this? Will it kind of pop back up as the campaign intensifies before November?
I mean, I think it might. I mean, the only reason why this thematic gets such traction is because religion, the connection between religion, morality, and political leadership is so incredibly important these days, right? That's why these candidates go out for all of these endorsements from high and religious figures, even when sometimes they backfire on them. So I think as long as America is invested in itself as a religious nation, all these politicians are going to have to negotiate some of this terrain. And if you're going to play with that kind of fire, if you're going to be interested in that kind of sort of authority and thinking about the U.S. in those terms, it comes with all of this other important and entrenched discourse that are part of what people imagine Christianity entails.
Professor John L. Jackson teaches communication and anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. I can tell you one thing, if I ever have to analyze an ad, I want you on my side.
I appreciate you saying that.
Thanks for talking with us on State of Belief, John.
Take care.
Well, so much for the clean politics we were promised this election season. Remember? I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. Right now, we've got to take a quick break. I'm going to try to get the sleaze off my hands while we go away. When we come back, the gospel according to Bruce Springsteen. From Thunder Road to the streets of Philadelphia, what these iconic American songs say about spirituality, hope, and redemption. Don't you go away. That's up next. Welcome back. You're listening to State of Belief. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Born down in a dead man's town.
This summer, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band head out on tour once again. And you may have heard diehard Springsteen fans describe seeing the Boss in concert as a religious experience. Maybe you are a diehard Springsteen fan yourself. Well, hyperbole and joking aside, my next guest says that there is something spiritual about many of Springsteen's songs. Songs about redemption and hope and the importance of community. Jeffrey Siemienkiewicz is a Unitarian Universalist minister, and he's the author of a new book entitled The Gospel According to Bruce Springsteen, Rock and Redemption from Asbury Park to Magic. Jeffrey joins me now to talk about this message of good news from the Boss. Jeffrey, welcome to State of Belief.
Hi, I'm very glad to be with you.
Great. Well, I'm interested to find out about this. What is it about Bruce Springsteen that speaks to you as a person of faith?
There are a lot of different things. I think the overriding thing that Springsteen gives us in his music and in his art and in his example that he presents is just the abiding hope that always sustains us and keeps us going, even though life is difficult and life is hard and things don't always go well, even for good people. Springsteen is really a prophet of hope, I think, and even it's a tenacious and a resilient hope. And he also is a man of very great faith, even though that faith might be a real unconventional faith at times.
Jeff, you write that Bruce Springsteen's songs can be gritty and unsentimental. They can be about desperation and heartbreak, but that hope always wins out, which you're saying. Can you tell us what song really illustrates that for you, perhaps in a way that others don't?
There are a lot of wonderful songs that do that, and that's probably if I had to pick one theme that comes out in more songs than any other, that would be it. Just a couple of examples. There's a song he has on his album called "The Devil's Arcade," and it's about a returning veteran who comes back from the Iraq War, and he comes back wounded. He's a paraplegic, and it's going to be a long road to get him. To get him back, and he's been through really a living hell. But at the end of that, even in that terrible, bleak surroundings, with the help of the person who loves him, with the help of his community, he can sort of walk across the bridge of one moment at a time to finding that maybe there is a future awaiting him. It's a wonderful song. It's one of Springsteen's smaller songs, one that people might not even remember all that often.
Jeff, is the gospel, as you call it, of Bruce Springsteen a generally religious message, or is it a distinctly Christian message, or how would you categorize it?
That's a very good question. It's not Christian in a traditional sense, and it's certainly not Christian in a parochial sense. Springsteen was raised a Catholic. He was educated in the parochial schools in the town he grew up in New Jersey. It was sort of I don't think it was a love-hate relationship at first. I think it was a hate-hate relationship. But he said that in spite of the fact that he really didn't enjoy being in the parochial schools, that it carved a very rich landscape of imagery and belief and different kinds of ideas within him that he's been able to use in his songs, so that he's very conversant with traditional religious language, but he uses it in a wonderful universal kind of way to appeal to people of very different religions. When he was a young man, he was kind of hostile to organized religion, and that some of his early music is almost a caricature. When he talks about organized religion, it's almost a caricature of religion, especially of Catholicism. That's come to the point where on, again, the album Devils and Dust, he has a song called Jesus Was an Only Son, which is such a reverent and cadenced and beautiful song. It could almost come out of a mainline hymn book. Not quite, but almost, because it's a wonderful appreciation of the human side of Jesus and what that example offers to all of us as far as our own faith and hope and the living testimony of love in our lives.
Well, Jesus was an only son as he walked up Calvary.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you sent your book to him? Do you know
if I've tried to get his book to him through somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, which is, I don't know, it's a that seemed a little bit better than just putting it in the mail, because he probably gets an awful lot of mail, I'm sure. So we'll see if he responds. He doesn't tend to. He tends to be a man of great liberal sensibilities, not just as a political liberal, but even with his own art, he lets it move within people as it will. That he lets people interpret his songs for themselves. He doesn't like to impose too much of his own ideas on what people get out of his music.
Well, a quick question, and it needs a short answer now. What's your favorite Springsteen song, and briefly, why?
It's a very, very difficult question. It's like asking, you know, what's your favorite child? I think probably for my wife and I, there's a song called If I Should Fall Behind, which is our favorite song together, because it just so epitomizes the whole idea of commitment and journeying together with one another and just enjoying all the stages of life and taking life as it is, unvarnished and as unromanticized as it is. There's still a joy and a wonder and a deep love at the heart of love, at the heart of life.
We said we'd walk together, baby, come what may.
Jeffrey Simonkiewicz is the author of The Gospel According to Bruce Springsteen. He's a Unitarian Universalist minister in Massachusetts. If you're ever in that area, go hear him sometime, and I bet you hear something about Springsteen. Jeff, thanks so much.
I hear an awful lot about Springsteen. Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I'll wait for you. Should I fall behind, wait for me.
Coming up on State of Belief, I sit down with the Reverend Joan Brown Campbell, a great good friend for many years, a leading religious thinker and leader, and she'll share her thoughts on religion and the election. That's up next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
But each lover's steps fall so differently. But I'll wait.
Hello again, you're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy, and I'm broadcasting this week from the Chautauqua Institution in Upper New York State. I am here at Chautauqua, a center for education and culture, to speak at a week-long event on faith in public life. The event features many of the country's leading religious thinkers and leaders delivering lectures on religion in contemporary society. These are talks which are open to the general public and which are meant to enlighten and encourage a dialogue around this issue. Joining me now in the Chautauqua studios is the organizer of this event, the Reverend Joan Brown Campbell. Reverend Campbell is the director of the Department of Religion at the Chautauqua Institution, a position she took after a long and distinguished career in the religious community. Reverend Joan Brown Campbell previously served as the executive director of the U.S. Office of the World Council of Churches and as the general secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the USA. She has worked closely with many religious, civil rights, and political leaders. On her Rolodex and in her friendship list are people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Martin Luther King Jr. and President Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela, and on it goes. She is a tireless advocate for democracy, and she works out of a strong base of faith. Joan Brown Campbell, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We've been talking about religion and the campaign. What are, in your mind, the key religious issues in this campaign?
Well, obviously, there are many that could be defined as religious issues. Surely the war is one. One of the main religious issues is really how people feel about issues of war and peace. Not only whether we should have gone to war, but whether or how we should leave Iraq, if that becomes the question. Even though the pundits say, well, maybe that's not so strong now of an issue, I think it's still very strong. But I think there's another underneath issue that doesn't get, we get the issues of abortion, gay marriage, those kind of issues are always surfaced. But I think there's an underneath issue that we don't talk about, but I think it's a deeply religious issue. That's really the issue of the economy. Because who's affected by an economy that goes bad?
Why aren't we talking about it?
I think people are afraid of it, in one sense. It's deeply personal. It's deeply private to some people. The fact that Cleveland, where I come from, more people are having their houses taken away from them, more mortgages have failed than in almost any other city. And believe me, in the city, they're talking about those issues. They don't seem to surface as much at the national level, but I would imagine if the candidates go into town after town in this country, they're going to get asked questions, no matter whether it's named the economy. They really are questions of how are people doing in their personal lives, in their ability to educate their children. All of these things are huge for Americans, I think.
And those economic issues, by any estimate, I think, are religious issues.
Well, yes. I mean, people call them economic issues. They're profoundly issues of faith. Who has resources and who doesn't? What happens every single time, as you well know? We have an economic downturn. It's inevitably the poor that become poorer. Often it affects women more than it does others. It certainly affects young people, and it affects people new into the job market. Jobs are hard to come by, and I think those are deeply issues of faith. Every pastor will tell you that in their congregation, they have people that have lost their homes. Divorces have resulted from that. They have people that used to have enough money, certainly to get by, if not a little more, and that's not true anymore. People are turning out for church suppers more than they used to, not because the food's so great, but because there's plenty of food.
Well, a lot of the speakers this week have pointed out that this discussion about faith in public life is by no means a new one. It's been a part of the debate in this country since the beginning of our country, I guess. Meacham, John Meacham of Newsweek and the Washington Post's On Faith column, spoke here early in the week and pointed out that failing to consider the past commits us to the tyranny of the present. Now, for you, Joan, what are some of the most important lessons from that past?
Well, I think one of the things that is one of the most important lessons is the vital role that religious liberty has always played in this nation's history. I was fascinated, Welton, that Christians, Muslims, and Jews alike across the board, whether they were conservative or liberal or whatever tag you put on people, the one point of agreement really was that religious liberty matters.
I just saw this study that indicated that in the campaign so far, the candidates have spent almost as much time talking about religion as they have about foreign policy. And that bothers me.
Yeah, me too. I think that's a very disturbing thing to know.
I'm wondering, what do you think, what do you fear most about religion's role in this election?
Well, what I fear is exactly what you just stated, and that is it plays an exaggerated role. All of a sudden, it seems to make a huge amount of difference to Americans as to what religious group someone belongs to. The fact of the matter is, it's been said over and over again, that religion is someone's personal and private matter, and that we really oughtn't to judge people on what denomination do they belong to, what history do they have, what values they have is huge. And religious people, just like everybody else, ought to be asking the questions, separate and apart from their religious history. Frankly, whether someone is a born-again Christian or not should not be a part of our debate and our dialogue. Whether someone is a conservative Jew or a liberal Jew, or whether what I think these are the things that worry me. Instead of getting down to the questions of why do we have hungry people and what do you, the candidate, what do you think you should do about that? What's going to happen to the issues in the Middle East? How are you going to be a peacemaker? Those are religious questions, but they're not framed in that way.
Joan, can you point during this past week to one moment that really made you stop and think? And maybe you were surprised, or maybe it raised a new question for you about faith in public life. Was there such a moment?
I think it really was this morning, Welton, when young Eboo Patel spoke. And here's a 32-year-old young man, began a youth corps, is beginning to teach people how to do interfaith work. Not assume that they know how, not have a focus group, not have everybody over for dinner and think they're all going to get along, but teach them how to do it. And part of what he's teaching them is that we need to be able to find our common voice if we're going to address public life. It's remarkable what he's been able to do with young people. And I guess the reason it was so important to me was, I think what he really was a harbinger of hope. When he talked about why he thinks young people are so invested in this particular election, and he talked about the way Obama and the way he speaks to people has a particular resonance with young people, and that was a surprising comment, that the way in which he really delved into that in terms of why did those words particularly make a difference for young people. And I asked him a tough question. I said, well, what happens if somebody else wins? And he said, well, he thinks young people are invested in the nation at this point. And maybe it's been the war, maybe it's been what they've seen, and maybe it's a reaction against a generation that maybe wasn't as concerned. And those were surprising insights for me.
If you could take what we have shared and learned here at Chautauqua this week, and you could share it with the two candidates fairly briefly, what would you say to John McCain and Barack Obama?
Well, I think I would say to both of them that they don't need to wear their faith on the sleeve, but that what they do need to know is that faith does matter. And I think what I would say to both of them is, take the faith community seriously, but take seriously the diversity of the faith community. That, I think, is the most important thing they need to hear. It's not a community of like-minded people. And there's no way they can say, I'm only going to go to the evangelicals, their vote matters, or I'm only going to go to the Black community, or I'm only going to go to the liberal community. They need to speak to the diversity of the religious community. It's pretty powerful in this country.
Has this week changed Joan Brown Campbell in any way?
Well, it always just, you know, I'm by now a grandmother of eight people, and they are people. Five of them are voters. And It re-energizes me. I love seeing the audience reaction to this and the nitty-gritty back and forth. It's probably, of all the weeks at Chautauqua so far, this has had more interaction between people of different viewpoints. So I'm by nature an optimist and somebody who wants to keep going at this business. And I suppose it makes me feel re-energized for this work. You, of all people, know this. You can get discouraged in this interfaith work. And sometimes the progress is minimal, and you see a week like this, and you realize we have made progress. I think that was Eboo's great gift. Here's this young man willing to take this on, and he's got a lifetime to give to us.
Joan Brown Campbell is director of the Religion Department of the Chautauqua Institute in New York. She's formerly the General Secretary of the National Council of the Churches. She is my good friend and a friend to this nation. Joan, thank you.
Thank you, Welton.
I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief. I'm seriously worried, and even worried out loud on this program, that in this election cycle, way too much time has been spent talking about the candidates in religion. Whether it's media coverage of a controversial pastor or the candidates espousing their religious beliefs as presidential credentials. And honestly, this week, my fears have been confirmed as I read a new study from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life that says almost as much time has been spent by the candidates talking about religion in this election as they have spent talking about foreign policy. Now think about that, friends. You can bet I've got some thoughts on it, and you will hear them after this break. Please don't go away. We're coming right back. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. We're about out of time today, but before we go, I want to draw your attention to a report that the Pew Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism and the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life have just published. And really, this report confirms many of my worst fears about the use of religion on the campaign trail. The Pew Center analyzed over 13,000 news stories from January 2007 through April 2008, and the researchers found that 10% of all stories that weren't about campaign tactics or strategy, you know, the horse race analysis, those stories aside, nearly 10% of all the media coverage concentrated on religion and the election. That means that almost as much time has been spent on religion as on foreign policy. Now think about that. The United States is in the midst of two wars, one of which is costing our taxpayers $6 billion every month. Terrorism represents the greatest foreign policy crisis of our generation. And instead of concentrating on these pressing issues, the news is about Obama's relationship with Reverend Jeremiah Wright or stories on how to corral evangelical voters or an account of how to win the endorsement of someone in the religious community that is of outstanding note. Now, let me ask you, be honest about this. Is that the kind of coverage that's helpful to the American public as we seek a true understanding of the candidates' positions on Afghanistan or Iraq? I don't think so. Now, please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that religion can't be incorporated into the presidential campaign. That's not the problem. The problem is that religion is being used as a divisive tool instead of a force for unifying reconciliation. The candidates need to be less concerned with appearing holier than thou and focus instead on explaining the role their values play in their political worldview. It's not a question of what faith a candidate comes from or if a candidate embraces any faith at all, which is fine too. Look, the question is how what a candidate believes influences how that candidate functions in office and whether or not public office is going to be a perpetual platform, a bully pulpit for advocating personal beliefs. Now, if we were asking substantive questions about how candidates' beliefs were impacting their candidacy and how it would impact their term in office, and they were answering those questions, that would be fine. I would be tickled to death to see the media paying attention to that. But you know, and I know, that's not the case. Now, friends, these are the types of stories we pay attention to at State of Belief, because we think getting this relationship between religion and politics right is important for those of us who hold to a faith and for those of us who believe in freedom and for those of us who believe in freedom and have no faith. And I have to ask, is the message of State of Belief a message that you would be willing to support? I want to thank everyone, every listener, who has heard me talk about State of Belief and the financial state we're in, and those who have gone to our website and donated. I am particularly grateful for you. We can't thank you enough, but we still could use more help. If you haven't given to us, would you consider making a contribution that could help keep State of Belief on the air? If so, then please go to our website, stateofbelief.com, where you can make a donation to the program on the Support Us page. And while you're there, I wish you'd share some of your thoughts about the show. Tell us what you think about the amount of press space that's been dedicated to religion in this election season. How would you like to hear the candidates talk about religion, or would you just as soon they not talk about religion? Let us know at stateofbelief.com. Well, that's our show for this week. I'm going to have to leave this beautiful place here at Chautauqua, and I will say thank you to them in many different ways, but I want to say a very special thank you to Matt Wilson, who is here at the Chautauqua Institute and has been the engineer for our show this week. And thank you to all of our listeners for spending time with us. As always, we wouldn't be able to bring this program to the airwaves each week without listeners like you, who become members of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Even before this show concludes, we're looking forward to bringing you next week's show. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.